Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Here's the podcast from Susie Larson Live. Enjoy the conversation. It's only just a matter of. Welcome, welcome to Susie Larson Live. I'm always honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, years ago, I read a couple of short stories on a young woman named Sophie Scholl, and I've talked about her several times on the show because those short stories just never left me, and her courage, her conviction undid me completely. And since then, I have longed for someone to write a novel on Sophie's life. And you know, guess what? Someone has. I'm so excited about it. You know, it's important to read stories of courage and conviction to learn from those who've gone before us. Well, best-selling novelist Amanda Barrett joins me today to talk about her latest novel, The White Rose Resists, a novel of the German students who defied Hitler. I just got to tell you, I read a lot of books. And once in a while, I'm thinking about a book days, sometimes weeks after I've read the last page. This is one of those books. I'm still thinking about it. Actually, I want to go back and read it again. And we've got six copies of this amazing novel to give away. You know the drill. If you listen often enough, you just text the word book to 877-933-2484. Text the word book to 877-933-2484. If you're new to the Faith Radio family, whether you're listening to the live show or the podcast after the fact, when you text book, it'll kick back a link and just take you a moment, fill it out, and you're in the drawing. And I hope you win because you'll love the book. Quick announcement before we hear from Amanda. Just want to say we are a listener-supported ministry. We couldn't do what we do without you, and you know, we wouldn't want to either. The Faith Radio Network is growing by leaps and bounds. That's our Faith Radio Network is just this conglomeration of stations and all kinds of online initiatives as well. And podcast is growing as well. It's just an amazing thing. And all of that happens because of you. And I just wanted to pause and say we appreciate you. We pray for you. We're so grateful for you. So thank you. All right, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get her on the show. Amanda Barrett is the ECPA best-selling author of several novels and novellas, including My Dearest Dietrich. She's a member of the American Christian Fiction Writers, and she's a two-time FHL Reader's Choice Award finalist. She and her family live in northern Michigan, and we're honored to have her with us today. Amanda, so great to meet you. Welcome to the program.
It is such a joy to be here with you, Susie. Thank you.
Looking forward to the conversation. And as I mentioned to you off the air, we love to start every day talking scripture. And I'm wondering if there's a passage you've been pondering these days you can share with us.
Absolutely. So there is a scripture verse that's been speaking to my heart, and it was actually one of Sophie Scholl's favorite verses as well. And it's James 1:22, but be doers of the word and not hearers only. And I love that verse because I think that we have to really, as we're reading the word, we have to think, are we applying it to our lives? Are we living the word? And so that verse has been ministering to my heart as well lately.
I appreciate that so much. Well, if you don't mind, Amanda, give us a little backstory on your faith journey and then specifically how you came to write historical fiction.
So I have always loved reading, and I really am a huge believer in the transformational power of story, that, you know, a story in novels can reach readers that perhaps a biography or some nonfiction text might not. And so I began writing just out of a deep heart for that, and it took me many, many years of pursuing the craft of writing, lots of rejection letters and lots of discouragement, but I kept pursuing it because I feel that God really laid it on my heart to share these stories to bring hope and encouragement to readers. And then after writing several historical romance novellas, I moved into writing novels based on true stories. And my first novel, My Dearest Dietrich, told the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his fiancée, Maria von Weidemeyer. And then The White Rose Resists tells the story of Sophie Scholl and the German college students who resisted Hitler.
Amanda, how did you get your first break? First of all, I appreciate what you're saying about the backstory of that journey, because we at Faith Radio with the university across the street, University of Northwestern, we partner and we put on a national writers conference every summer for the purpose of helping people get published. And so often people think someone decides to get published and it's just that easy, but it just absolutely is not. There are rejections, there are setbacks, and you have to learn the craft. So tell me, you know, how did you get your break?
So I spent many, many years seriously studying the craft of writing and attended conferences, the American Christian Fiction Writers Conference, and there I met my literary agent, and then So she began to pitch my work to various publishers, and then a few years after that, I signed a contract with Barbara Publishing for a novella to be included in one of their historical romance anthologies. And from there, I was privileged and very blessed to be able to do several more novellas that then kind of came into me doing these longer novels based on true stories.
Very good. Well, how did you first learn about the life of Sophie Scholl?
So researching and writing my novel about Dietrich Bonhoeffer led me to Sophie's story. I was reading a book about youth in Nazi Germany, and I came across her story and the story of the White Rose, and I immediately wanted to know what would make these young students decide to take this incredible risk, to stand up and to print and distribute these leaflets and risk their lives. And it was merely from this personal curiosity of wanting to answer the question for myself. But the more I dug and the more I explored and the more I came to know Sophie and the other students of the White Rose, the more I wanted to share their lives in a fictional format.
Well, for those who don't know Sophie's story or even what the White Rose is, tell us a little bit about it.
So the White Rose was a group of German college students that they all attended the University of Munich during in 1942. Hans Scholl, Sophie's older brother, and his friend Alex Schmorell decided that they could no longer be bystanders. And they had previously, in the 1930s, been involved in the Hitler Youth. They were young men, and so they were, you know, indoctrinated into that. But the more that they became to know about Nazi ideology, the more that they had to step away. And that led to their taking this resistance, and they used a secondhand duplicating machine and a Remington typewriter and began cranking out these leaflets in the middle of the night and distributing them. And then Sophie came along right around at the time that they began doing all of this, and she started to attend the university. And when she found out, she immediately knew that she had to take part in this, even though it was going to cost, could very well cost her life.
And again, you think about the courage and the conviction for these students to take such an audacious risk. And they were, you know, university students by day and then working at times through the night to print these things up and then going out at night to and separating them out the pamphlets so that they get into different mailboxes so that there's not, suspicion aroused there. I mean, I can't believe what they did. As you're working through the story, anything else stand out about it?
Well, so many things stood out about me, the variety of students. They were all committed Christians, but they all came from different backgrounds. Alex Schmorell, Hans's close friend and one of the core members of the group, he was actually part Russian, and so he was a student at the university, but he was also a soldier because all young men had to be a soldier, and he actually refused to take the oath of loyalty to Hitler because he believed that he could not stand with Hitler by speaking those words. And Christoph Probst was another member. He was only in his early 20s, and he had a wife and two small children, and his wife was pregnant with their third child, and he became involved in the group, and that eventually led to his execution, and his wife had a baby, and the baby was only a few weeks old.
Talk about the White Rose, what the meaning behind that.
So the name The White Rose, how they kind of came across about with that name is rather ambiguous. Hans Scholl later said in his interrogation transcripts, which I was able to read, that there are some words that just evoke a certain emotion and feeling. And so he believed that the White Rose symbolized purity and it symbolized, you know, truth. And so that's kind of how they came about with using that name.
Okay, well, talk to me a little bit more about Sophie's character. I mean, what parts, you know, you did a lot of research, you did a lot of study. What parts, help readers who have not read the book, obviously, get an inside look about what she was like, things that you learned from your research that you're weaving into the story of her everyday life, of trying to navigate this, trying to face down her own fears, and then finding her conviction growing. I mean, just say more about, help us get to know her.
So she was about 12 years old when Hitler came to power, and like I said, she was also involved in the League of German Girls. But even at that young age, even as an early teenager, she was concerned when she saw that two of her friends who were Jewish, they could not be a part of the Hitler Youth Organization, but yet she could, and so she questioned that. And she questioned when her family received an anonymous leaflet in their mailbox, a duplicated sermon from a man named Bishop Clemens von Galen, and he was writing and speaking out against the horrific Reich euthanasia program, which was murdering thousands of people. And when they received this leaflet, the Scholl family and the Scholl children particularly were stirred and thought that leaflets could be a way to passively resist. Sophie was engaged to an officer in the German army, and he was a career officer, and through their relationship, he began to change and began to become more active against the regime. It was fascinating. Right, the last time Sophie saw him before her, she was executed was in May, and she went ahead and she told him the leaflet operation, and he said, "Are you aware this could cost you your life?" And she said, "Yes, I know."
We're going to pause here. When we come back, we'll talk more about Sophie's life, about just the work that they did behind the scenes. I would love to know the impact of those leaflets before they were executed. Was it making waves? Were they getting through, or did things have to play out in their lives and their execution for people really to wake up and see what was going on? Talking to Amanda Barrett. She wrote the book, The White Rose Resists, the novel of the German students who defied Hitler. It's just a gripping novel. We got 6 copies to give away. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484, and we will be back in a moment. Thanks so much for tuning into Susie Larson Live. I'm talking to novelist Amanda Barrett. She wrote the novel, The White Rose Resists, a novel of the German students who defied Hitler. And we're talking about Sophie Scholl. I've brought her up before, but I read a couple short stories about her years ago, and her story just gripped me. But these are students in Germany, in the university, who just could not... imagine how many Germans hated what was happening, Amanda. I think about that, because there were multiple attempts on Hitler's life from inside some of his closest people. Do you ever wonder why God didn't allow one of those people to succeed? I mean, maybe that's a terrible question, but he'd done so much evil, and you can imagine the trouble and the tension for so many who knew that he was just inhumane with the way that he treated people.
Oh, absolutely. And yes, I have wondered that. I've studied, Klaus von Stauffenberg's July 20th, 1944 attempt on Hitler's life and the other ones preceding. I did a lot more digging into that with my novel about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, because Dietrich Bonhoeffer was kind of involved in that Berlin resistance network. And it breaks my heart to think about these people who are risking their lives and the courage. And I think that's one of those questions that, probably will never be answered this side of heaven. Then it's one of those areas where we just have to trust, even though it's one of those areas where it feels so very hard sometimes as we study the history.
So these students, we're picturing these students going to, educated, they're at the university, and then at night they're meeting in this dark shop, with a printer printing out these leaflets. And talk about what these leaflets or pamphlets, what they said.
So they were incredibly bold. They produced 6 leaflets in 1942 and 1943, and it was terrible risk because they had to not only produce the leaflets, but they had to get the supplies, and that meant going to multiple shops throughout the city to get enough paper and envelopes and stamps. And of course, once the Gestapo found out, they were searching for them. And their first leaflet began, "Nothing is so unworthy of a civilized nation as to allow itself to be governed without resistance by an irresponsible clique that has yielded to base instincts. It is certainly the case today that every honest German is ashamed of his government." And they quoted from Ecclesiastes. They quoted from Goethe in their leaflets. They really spoke incredibly boldly for that time. They spoke out against the murder of the Jews, the horrible things that were going on in Poland, and they really did not mince words because they wanted their message to reach and to change as many people as it possibly could.
Well, so many people were bullied by their fears. If you imagine the kind of control that the Nazi regime had over the people, did they ever get a sense that they were making any waves, or was it to be found out after the fact, after the story played out? You know what I'm saying? Did these pamphlets get out and stir hearts? Did they have any way of finding that out?
They believe that they did. They didn't know for sure because it was hard to tell exactly who was reading them, but there was talk in the university that people were receiving these leaflets and that they were having impact, and their professor actually became drawn into their work because he received a leaflet. But it was really after their death and their execution that their message really began to have this broad reach. In the summer of 1943, one of the leaflets made its way into Great Britain, and it was reprinted by the millions and dropped over German cities by the RAF with a new heading, Manifesto of the Munich Students. And so they were then able to reach their countrymen after their deaths far more than they had ever while they were alive.
Isn't that always the way it is, it seems? You don't even see, you know, heroes don't know they're heroes when they're acting heroically. And but for these students doing these pamphlets, and then they started to find out about other cells in other parts of Germany who also were unhappy, who were trying to organize. And so their reach went beyond their local community. But they also got a little bold with graffiti. Was that part of your novel, or is that part of a fact?
That really happened in February of 1943, following the defeat at Stalingrad. Hans Scholl and his friend Alex Schmorell and some of the others, they went out on the streets and they painted 3 feet slogans on public buildings: "Freedom, down with Hitler," "Hitler the mass murderer." And the next day, people in Munich wake up and there's this written resistance in tar-based paint. And they did it a couple of times more, and that really stirred the city up and got a lot of attention.
Yeah, they seem to get bolder and bolder. And in the day that Hans and Sophie were caught, bring us to that day, because it seemed at night is when they were mostly working. And again, here they decide to distribute these leaflets at their university in broad daylight. And other of their friends thought they were taking too bold a risk. But bring us to that point.
So after the defeat at Stalingrad, they just seemed to be racing toward bolder and bolder plans. And on February 18th, 1943, Hans and Sophie took a suitcase and satchel full of leaflets to the university and were distributing them while morning classes were in session. And they were going on all 3 floors of the university, and they were at the top floor. And Sophie pushed a stack of leaflets over the balustrade, sending them scattering into the atrium below. And she was spotted by a janitor. And though they tried to blend into the crowd, the janitor apprehended them, and they were taken into Gestapo custody. And while in Gestapo custody, they were interrogated in separate rooms for 17 hours. And finally, after evidence was found in their apartment, they each confessed separately, wanting to spare their other comrades and to keep them safe and to be the only ones to bear the blame. And when the Gestapo realized that they caught the culprits, they immediately set the wheels in motion for a trial. And on February 22nd, they were tried at the People's Court in Munich, and there was this notorious Nazi judge who presided over the trial. And while at the trial, Sophie spoke out, and she said that somebody, after all, had to make a start. "What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They don't just dare express themselves as we did." And, of course, the judge sentenced all 3 of them, Hans, Sophie, and Christoph Probst, to death. And just a few hours later, they were executed at a prison in Munich, and their lives were ended. But their effect that their work had did continue to ripple out and did continue to touch people. Their word of their actions even reached concentration camps, where the inmates hugged each other and said, "After all, there are still human beings in Germany."
Wow. What amazes me, as I read those short stories about Sophie years ago, was about how she faced her executioners. They screamed at her. The court was in a rage, but she wouldn't be intimidated. In fact, she reminded them that they would one day stand before the ultimate judge. Can you talk about that moment in her story? Because, again, that is, I pray they do a movie. Maybe they'll make a movie out of your book. But, I mean, think about this. This is a young 20-something girl standing up to intimidating, screaming men who are telling her that her fate is in their hands. And they were supposed to give her 99 days. Isn't that the typical course of things when you're sentenced? You're supposed to have 99 days?
Yes, it is. And yes, they were executed just mere hours later. Their parents visited them, managed to make it to the prison and visit them just an hour before their execution. And yes, during the trial, they were all very bold. Hans Scholl was particularly bold, stating why he had done what he had done, even though he was a soldier who had taken the oath. You know, he was stating the real reasons and what Hitler was doing and how everyone, all the country people, were just blind to it. And so they all were incredibly bold. And Hans said, "Someday you will be standing where we are standing now," which was, you know, incredible. And of course, the judge screamed at them, but they knew that they were right. They knew that they were standing in faith on what God was telling them to do, and so they were not intimidated.
Well, this point in the story where Sophie's in her cell and she learns she doesn't have the typical 99 days given to the prisoners who face execution, she'd die that next day. I love how you conveyed her heart here, and you write, "This is Sophie. Oh, God, be with me. My heart is weak and feeble, but you are my strength. As clear as a whisper in my ear, the truths fill my mind. I don't have to do this alone. I am not alone. I am his, and he will walk beside me through everything. For years, I've wondered if my love for him was enough, questioned my worthiness to enter his presence. Tonight, I question no longer. Holy peace floods through me, inexplicable but present, and with peace comes sleep." Anything else about her story that stands out to you after all of your relentless research and after writing this story?
Well, there were so many things, especially as I was able to research and I was able to listen to interviews with family and friends, interviews with her sister Elizabeth, where her sister shared that if the Scholls today, they wouldn't necessarily want to be remembered as heroes because they were simply just doing the decent thing. They were doing what every German had done, should have been doing, and reading their interrogations and their trial transcripts and their execution records. Their execution records were particularly moving because there was this list of items that Sophie's parents could pick up for her that the prison sent to their parents and said, you could stop and pick these up. And just the normal items, there was, you know, a scarf and a box of matches, and there was the candy that her mother had brought to the prison, and that was there. And she didn't get to have it because she was executed. And those just cemented it that these were humans who were doing this. They weren't, you know, cardboard cutout martyrs, but they were real living, breathing men and women who dared to take a stand against this horrific evil.
And they're celebrated even today in Germany, aren't they?
Yes, they are. There are streets and schools named after them, and there was this poll run by this German TV channel that placed Sophie and Hans at fourth place above Bach and above Albert Einstein. So yes, today they are very much remembered as heroes in Germany.
Well, what are you working on next?
Currently, I'm working on a novel set in World War II Poland, and so it's a little bit more focused on the Holocaust than my previous novels, and it's a story of courage and sacrifice and resistance based on these true heroes who stood up in the darkness that was going on in World War II Poland, and I'm so excited about it and to share it with readers.
And when will that release?
The release date hasn't been determined yet. I'm still in like the researching writing process, but I should imagine late 2021 or early 2022.
Well, very good. Well, I got one more question for you, Amanda. What do you know about God now that you didn't know maybe even a few years ago?
Well, I believe that God is forever faithful and forever teaching us. And through this whole pandemic time, it has been a continual journey in trust, and trusting God for everything because, you know, we don't know what the future is going to hold. I mean, we have this fear now, or some of us do, you know, leaving our homes, you know, are we going to be exposed to this virus? And it really comes back to this ultimate trust and surrender to God that He holds our futures, and that as we lean on that, we truly can find peace. And I've definitely found a lot of peace through this whole time in spite of all this uncertainty and the tension.
You know, I guess I do have one more question for you as I'm thinking about it. When you think about the courage and conviction of the Scholls and their friends, speak to that issue for today, because this is a day where there's so much fear, there's so much angst and anger. What advice would you have for the person listening today about wanting to live with humility, courage, and conviction?
Well, Hans Scholl wrote this letter, and he asked the question, should one go off and build a little house with flowers outside the windows and a garden outside the door and extol and thank God and turn one's back on the world and its filth? And he asked, isn't seclusion a form of treachery, of desertion? And then he said, I'm weak and puny, but I want to do what is right. And I feel that, you know, they did these great things, but yet they felt themselves weak, and they had to rely on God for their strength, and they believed that to be secluded and to be isolated from the world was indeed a form of treachery and desertion. And I think as Christians, each of us has a responsibility to live for God and to play out living for God in the real, messy, broken world.
Wow, that's a great answer, and I love what you read there from Hans. Thank you for this time, and I look forward to having you come back to talk about your next novel. We'll be thinking about you as you're writing away. God bless you, Amanda. We sure appreciate it.
Oh, God bless you too, Susie. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you. Talking to Amanda Barrett, her book, The White Rose Resists. We've got 6 copies to give away. Text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. Hope you found some encouragement here. We'll be back in just a moment. So many good songs out these days. I love it. Thanks for tuning into Susie Larson Live. And I love that you're listening today. If you just tuned in, you missed the first half of the show. And if you've been listening the whole way through, you know I just spoke with novelist Amanda Barrick. And we talked about her compelling novel, The White Rose Resists. And it's based on the true story of a young German university student who dared to defy Hitler. Sophie Scholl is considered a hero to many, and I've always found her story fascinating. So for someone to write a novel about it just was gripping. So if you haven't heard that yet, forget, if you didn't get to hear the first half of the show, when the live show's over, it goes up to podcast. Be sure to go back and listen. Now we're going to switch gears, and we're going to welcome Abby Johnson back to the show. I spoke with her a number of years ago about her book, Unplanned, the dramatic true story of a former Planned Parenthood leader's eye-opening journey across the lifeline. And she joins us today to talk about her new five-part film series titled Beautiful Lives. So let me tell you about her. We'll get her on the show. Abby Johnson is the host of the Beautiful Lives series and a founder of And Then There Were None, a ministry designed to assist abortion clinic workers in transitioning out of the industry. She travels across the globe sharing her story, including her work with Planned Parenthood, educating the public on pro-life issues and advocating for the unborn. She resides in Texas with her husband and, count them, seven precious children. Abby, good to talk with you again today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, of course. Thanks for having me on.
Seven children. I just think it's amazing. God bless you.
Well,
I love it.
I need to update that because I actually have eight now. So
wow. Oh, my word. You are a superhero in so many senses of the word, Abby. Golly, that's amazing. How old is your youngest then?
He's a year old.
Man, congratulations.
Thank
yeah,
you.
They need to do a reality show on your life. I'm just saying, I would watch it. So anyway, so good to talk with you. Well, we love to start every day talking scripture, and I'm wondering if there's a verse you've just been hanging around or pondering these days you can share with us.
Well, my favorite passage of scripture, and really has been for the past 10 years, is Psalm 30, and it's just the Psalm of Deliverance, and it's such a beautiful passage. I read it almost every day when I wake up or when I go to sleep, and just talks about God's goodness and how he turns our sorrow into dancing and our tears into dancing. And I love that is who God is, and that he can use every part of our lives, every part of our story for his glory. And how he just loves to shower his mercy on our lives.
Yeah, so true. Thank you for sharing. That's great. For those who may not be familiar with your story, I mean, I know many are, but for those who aren't, give us a little backstory as a context for our conversation today.
Yeah, so I worked at Planned Parenthood, our country's largest abortion provider, for 8 years of my life. I was a clinic director there and left in 2009 after several things, but ultimately left after witnessing a live ultrasound-guided abortion procedure where I saw a 13-week-old baby fight and struggle for his life against the abortion instruments. And I knew then that there was humanity in the womb. I knew that there was life in the womb. And I knew that if those two things were true, that I was on the wrong side of this abortion debate. And so I ended up leaving my job in the clinic and started speaking out against the evils of abortion, and started really trying to expose what abortion is to the public, but also really tried to bring about healing and to talk about God's forgiveness, because there are 60 million recorded abortions since the legalization of abortion in 1973, and that means there are millions and millions of women and men who are experiencing the heartbreak of abortion. And so while we mourn the loss of these millions of babies, we also recognize that there are other victims of abortion, and that's these men and women who are suffering and struggling. And so, you know, part of my mission and my ministry is really trying to bring healing to them as well.
Well, I'm so grateful, because, you know, so many go into it not really understanding if they've received a narrative that says that this is not a baby. You can imagine walking through the abortion, coming out the other side and going, why is my soul traumatized? Why do I feel the way I do? So I love that there's so many aspects to your ministry, and you're considering the whole, you know, the one that we've grieving, that we've lost, and those who are still walking around this earth with a broken heart. If you don't mind, take us to that day, that moment, then you knew you had to leave Planned Parenthood. I mean, friends, if you haven't seen the film Unplanned, it's so powerful and such an important film to see. You've got to see it. But take us to that moment where you thought, I'm crossing over the line. My life is about to drastically change. Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, I remember feeling shocked. I remember feeling You know, I didn't, people have asked, you know, did you feel just disgusted? Did you, you know, I mean, did you just feel sick to your stomach? And I didn't really in that moment. I did later, but in that moment, I just felt like I was in shock. I couldn't believe what I was seeing because it wasn't supposed to look like that. It wasn't supposed to be moving. This baby wasn't supposed to be feeling what was happening. This wasn't supposed to be happening. And I had so easily lied to so many women, thousands of women for 8 years. I mean, these women had asked me over and over again, does the baby feel any pain? Does the baby feel anything? Is my baby going to feel pain? And I had so coolly and easily lied to them. And I wasn't a victim. I mean, I had eagerly lied to them and I had believed this lie because I wanted to keep my job. I wanted to make the money that I made. I, wanted to do what I was doing. And here I was facing this reality that it was all a lie and then having to live with that. And then wondering if I could actually face that reality. Because if you face the reality that you've been living a lie and you've been speaking a lie, then you have to come to terms with the truth. And, you know, I didn't know if I had the courage. I didn't know if I had the guts to admit what I had been a part of and then walk away from it. Because it'd be much easier for me to justify what I had seen than to face that truth.
I'm just so speechless when I think about, you know, 60 million. I cannot get my mind around it. It's like, Lord, have mercy on us. 60 million babies. And to think that the lie is perpetuated, that they don't feel anything. And so these little ones who feel everything, I mean, the fact that you saw in this ultrasound, this little baby trying to swim away from the instrument, to think that these babies are going through this without any, I mean, they're being murdered, but murdered without any kind of anything to help them numb the pain. I mean, just, I don't know how to phrase it, Abby. I just talk to me about the opposition that you faced after you made that courageous decision. And I'm not talking just physically as far as you suddenly have colleagues who have turned on you, but I would imagine you had spiritual opposition as well because the enemy himself hated the power that God was about to entrust to you. So say a word, if you would, about some of the opposition you faced once you took that step.
So when I left, Planned Parenthood actually, they sued me and they tried to get a permanent gag order against me. They were trying to prevent me from ever being able to tell my story and to talk about the things that I knew, you know, all of their dirty laundry, all of their secrets. Mm-hmm. And the interesting was that I had never intended to go public with my story. You know, former abortion workers are, that's really the Achilles heel of the abortion industry because we know too much. We know everything. And so when someone like me, you know, someone who is high up in management, someone who has been to all of the meetings, who, has been to all of the conferences, who knows all the ins and outs of the industry, when they leave, when a big fish, you know, for lack of a better term, when they leave, you have to shut them up. And so when they filed this lawsuit against me, that's what actually got picked up by the media. And that's, you know, the media, all of a sudden, they want to know, well, what does she know? Why are they trying to keep her quiet? That is what got picked up by Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. And that's what really catapulted me into the spotlight. So if they had not done what they did, if they had not put out this press release, if they had not sued me, I would not be doing what I'm doing right now.
Wow. Wow. Well, the film Unplanned, say a word about that and then talk about the response that you received afterward.
Well, I wrote my book Unplanned in 2011, and really it was very healing for me to just sort of get all of this out in the open. Wrote the book, didn't think much about it, started and then there were none. And, you know, was just sort of doing my thing. And then in 2015, had two writers, the writers and directors of God's Not Dead, come to me and ask me if I would ever consider putting Unplanned, if I'd ever consider turning it into a major motion picture, which of course I said, no, absolutely not. I would never do that. I don't know anything about film. And honestly, I've already been vulnerable enough. I don't want my story to be up on a big screen. That I have no desire. But, you know, I prayed about it. My husband was like, I really think you need to pray about it. This could really bring healing to a lot of people. So I did, and was really prompted to say yes. And so we said yes. We got the script written. And it took several years for God to work out the timing. And it was finally released in March of 2019, so March of last year. And it was just a huge box office success. It was number 4 in the box office. It ran in theaters for 14 weeks. And I should say it was number 4 on a quarter of the theaters that the other films were on. So huge success. Came out on video. It was number 1 in video sales for several weeks when it was released. So it's been a huge success. I mean, we have just heard thousands of babies that have been saved because their mothers watched the film, thousands of people who whose hearts have been converted from pro-choice to pro-life. And that's really what the movie was about. It wasn't about making Abby Johnson a household name. They could have made it about anybody, Alice Jones, for all I care. It was really about showing the goodness of God and the power of God's mercy.
What a courageous, dear sister you are. We're going to pause here. When we come back, I want you to talk about your new series, Beautiful Lives. I mean, I just watched the trailer and I was holding my breath. Absolutely amazing. Talking to Abby Johnson today. If you have not seen the film Unplanned, you must. And check out her book as well, Unplanned, the dramatic true story of a former Planned Parenthood leader's eye-opening journey across the lifeline. I really do believe God has raised you up, Abby, for such a time as this. We'll be back in a moment. Thanks for tuning into Susie Larson Live. Glad to have you listening today. An important show, talking to Abby Johnson. And God has raised her up to be an advocate for the unborn and for those who've parents who have had an abortion and are on the other side of it and realizing what a mistake they made. And for those who are coming out of the industry who know a lot and suddenly the light bulb went on and they see that this is not the right side of this conversation. Abby, you've got a new series that you started called Beautiful Lives. Say more about it.
Yeah. After Unplanned was released, I think that, you know, the next question that a lot of people had was, okay, so are there more people like you? Are there other people who have left the abortion industry who have had these, you know, big conversions? Where are they? You know, are they speaking out too? And so that was sort of a natural introduction to, and then there were none, the ministry that I founded in 2012. And to date, we're right at 600 abortion clinic workers who have left the abortion industry and have had, you know, radical conversions into the pro-life movement. More importantly, they've had radical conversions and now have relationships with Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Which is really the goal. And so, you know, Pureflix came to me and said, look, we're getting these questions too. How about we highlight some of these stories and let's see how it goes. And maybe we can continue highlighting them. And so we started with just a 5-part series. So one of the parts is my story and sort of just introducing people to my story and then there were none and why we do what we do. And then the other 4 parts shows 4 other women who have left the abortion industry. And they didn't, you know, I think a lot of times people think about the abortion industry and they think about a brick and mortar abortion clinic. But what's really interesting about Beautiful Lives is that you're going to hear stories of the abortion industry, but it's outside of those brick and mortar clinic walls. And so I think what's really telling about this series and why people really need to watch it is because you're going to see how the abortion lobby has seeped into many, many different places of our lives, maybe places that you haven't even thought of. But it shows how vigilant we must be with our children and our communities and our friends, and how abortion is really, it's gotten into every place. I mean, so many places, so many people that we encounter.
Say more about that, that it's beyond the brick and mortar. I mean, give some examples of what you mean there.
So one of the stories that you're going to hear is from a woman named Monica Klein, who was a comprehensive sex educator. And, you know, many people probably watching Beautiful Lives, you know, you hear, oh, okay, she's a sex educator. She, you know, teaches sex ed to kids in schools. And most people watching that would go, okay, no big deal. My kid's in school. Yeah, sure. They have a health teacher that, you know, teaches that to them in school because I don't want to do it, right? That's an awkward conversation. So sure, let somebody else do it. But that is essentially a gateway to allowing abortion and other things that you would not want your children to hear about. They're pushing that onto our children. And it's an opportunity to break the relationship between parent and child. Parents are they are basically a barrier to service. So, wow. You know, our whole point of getting into the school system, our whole point of getting access to your children is to get you away from your children so that when your child does have an unplanned pregnancy, they won't go to you first. They will come to us as sex educators. And she talks about that in detail. In her part of the series of Beautiful Lives. We have a woman in one of the series who is a researcher at a major university, and she talks about the research program. Now, these are research programs that are paid for with your tax dollars and mine, that are going through major universities all across this country. And she was a research director, and one day she was told that they were going to be starting a project, and that she was going to be overseeing, and she opened up a styrofoam box, and inside that box were tiny baby parts. And she realized that these baby parts were from aborted babies that they were going to be researching. And on her computer was a drop-down list of different body parts, legs, arms, brain, liver. And she realized, oh my gosh, I'm going to be running a research program on aborted babies. And so, you know, this far extends past that brick and mortar abortion clinic that you think of when you think of abortion. This is being funded by our tax dollars. It's, you know, these sex educators are preying upon your children. It's everywhere. And so we must keep our eyes and ears open, and we must remain vigilant.
So Abby, did you notice or identify a common denominator as to why these different people left the industry and decided to become pro-life, or they're just a varying number of reasons?
You know, it's just a varying number of reasons. For some people, it's very fast. You know, like it for me, it was sort of seeing that ultrasound, you know, and just saying, oh my gosh, I've got to get out of here. You know, for some, it was having their own child and saying, what am I doing? You know, I'm taking this opportunity away from these other women. Look at how precious my child is. How can I do this to another woman? For some people, it's something totally different. For some people, it's little things over a time that finally add up to them saying, I am not participating in this anymore. It's all very different, but all of them will tell you that it was like having blinders taken off, having a veil lifted. And they will all tell you that it was spiritual for them.
Wow.
That they were fighting a spiritual battle in their own heart, and that, you know, finally evil lost and that God won.
You know, I spoke with an woman who'd been an OB nurse for about 30 years, and she said, never once in my career was there a scenario that killing the baby would have helped the mother? She said, I am not a doctor, I'm a nurse, but I can't think of one scenario. Yet you hear that argument often. Like, that's like the, you know, the centerpiece of, you know, we're champions for women. I mean, say a word about that and just other things we maybe need to know about the industry that we're just maybe taking, you know, face value, and we don't really know what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, that is interesting you bring that up, because that's actually something that's talked about in one of the episodes of Beautiful Lives. There's an abortion clinic nurse that's interviewed in one of the segments. She actually worked for a late-term abortion provider, and that's one of the things that they talk about in her segments is, you know, all the times that, you know, women would come in for late-term abortions, so third trimester abortions, and of course they're going to this late trimester abortionist, and you know, they're, of course, all the people are saying, well, because it's for, you know, the health of the mother. But, you know, she will sit there and say in this series that, you know, there was never a time where abortion was truly needed to save the life of the mother. You know, in those situations, what's needed is a safe delivery for the baby. You provide as much care for the baby that you can, and you do what you can to save the life of the mother. And sometimes the baby will die naturally. But there's never a time where you have to kill the baby in order to save the life of the mother. And it's interesting because it's not the, there's nothing about killing the baby that's going to save the woman. The woman still has to deliver. Even if you kill the baby in the womb, it's not like you kill the baby and the baby suddenly disappears into magical fairy dust. She still has to deliver that dead child. So if she's going to have to deliver the child anyway, you might as well deliver the child and provide as much care to that child as you possibly can. Even if that child dies, give that child the possibility of life. Give that mother an opportunity to hold her baby. Even if the child dies, give that child some dignity in the final moments of his life.
Amen. What are some of the ways that moms and dads who've aborted struggle after the fact? Maybe they went in being pro-choice. They came out the other side going, why does my heart break so much? What does the PTSD look like for them?
Well, we know that, you know, women who have abortions are 6 times more likely to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. We know that they are more likely to have clinical depression, to have generalized anxiety. We know they're more likely to suffer with eating disorders. We know that they're more likely to have post-traumatic stress syndrome. So we know that they're at higher risk for many complications, emotional complications, and also physical complications. So, you know, and now we're finding out, you know, we don't have any studies on this yet, but hopefully we will soon, but also, you know, how it affects men involved. You know, we have seen so many times going, you know, when I'm out standing in front of abortion clinics praying and trying to reach out to these women, men coming out, and they're absolutely devastated that they're unable to save the life of their child. We've seen men, you know, standing on the side of the fence with us, pleading and begging for these women not to abort their child, and men have no say in the decision. And, you know, these men are wrecked and their souls are ravaged because the life of their child was taken.
Can't even imagine. Well, our time has just gone so fast, Abby. Just one last quick question before we wrap today. Where can people find this series, Beautiful Lives?
Yeah, they can find it on PureFlix. If you're not a subscriber to PureFlix, you can sign up for a free 7-day trial. You can find it there, and I hope that people will sign up, that they'll watch. I think that you'll get a lot of great information from there.
Abby, we just thank you, really, for your heroic, amazing work, and I love you have 8 kids. It's amazing. Thanks for giving us your time today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, I hope you'll come back again. And friends, thanks for tuning in today. There's something we can all do. Stand in the gap. We can pray. We can support organizations that are pro-life. Jesus is pro-life. We are pro-life proudly. And we want to see this end in our lifetime. It could happen, right? Thanks for tuning in today. We'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this Susie Larson Live podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can become a supporter today at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the show, you can subscribe to the podcast now at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of the show. Thanks for listening to Susie Larson Live.